This is Audible.
White Noise by Don DeLillo. Copyright 1984-1985 by Don DeLillo. This recording of the full-length reading of White Noise was published by arrangement with the Wallace Literary Agency, Incorporated, and was produced in 1999 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Michael Pritchard. This book consists of 40 chapters and is 326 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Don DeLillo's new masterpiece of a novel, a brilliant story about death and fear of death, is a comedy, of course. Jack Gladney teaches the history of Nazism at a small liberal arts college in Middle America, where his colleagues include New York expatriates who want to immerse themselves in American magic and dread. Jack longs for a quiet, plotless existence, thinking desperately that this is the way to escape death. And he finds some solace with his beloved wife Babette and their ultra-modern children. The Gladneys are trying to navigate the usual passages of family life when an ominous airborne toxic event, a black cloud of lethal gaseous fumes released in an industrial accident, threatens to engulf their town. Jack's life then becomes enmeshed in plots, complications, sexual deceptions, and a climactic murder scene. The poisonous black cloud is a more visible and urgent version of the white noise surrounding the Gladney family and all of us. Radio transmissions, sirens, ultrasonic and electronic waves, these omnipresent signals that buzz and hum all over America, both bewitch us and instill fear. Like the ancient music of Pan, white noise pulses with life and, at the same time, signals death. This prescient, deeply felt, and wonderfully zesty novel ends as the shocking dramas set off by the airborne toxic event force Jack to take surprising and heroic action. In White Noise, Don DeLillo has accomplished his most daring, most beautiful, and most exciting novel, a work that will surprise, console, and move his many enthusiastic readers. Dedication to Sue Buck and to Lois Wallace. Part 1. Waves and Radiation. Chapter 1. The station wagons arrived at noon, a long shining line that coursed through the west campus. In single file they eased around the orange I-beam sculpture and moved toward the dormitories. The roofs of the station wagons were loaded down with carefully secured suitcases full of light and heavy clothing, with boxes of blankets, boots and shoes, stationery and books, sheets, pillows, quilts, with rolled-up rugs and sleeping bags, with bicycles, skis, rucksacks, English and Western saddles, inflated rafts. As cars slowed to a crawl and stopped, students sprang out and raced to the rear doors to begin removing the objects inside. The stereo sets, radios, personal computers, small refrigerators and table ranges, the cartons of phonograph records and cassettes, the hair dryers and styling irons, the tennis rackets, soccer balls, hockey and lacrosse sticks, bows and arrows, the controlled substances, the birth control pills and devices, the junk food still in shopping bags, onion and garlic chips, nacho thins, peanut cream patties, waffalos and kabooms, fruit chews and toffee popcorn, the dum-dum pops, the mystic mints. I've witnessed this spectacle every September for 21 years. It is a brilliant event, invariably. The students greet each other with comic cries and gestures of sudden collapse. Their summer has been bloated with criminal pleasures, as always. The parents stand sun-dazed near their automobiles, seeing images of themselves in every direction. The conscientious suntans, the well-made faces and wry looks. They feel a sense of renewal, of communal recognition. The women crisp and alert, in diet trim, knowing people's names. Their husbands content to measure out the time, distant but ungrudging, accomplished in parenthood. Something about them suggesting massive insurance coverage. This assembly of station wagons, as much as anything they might do in the course of the year, more than formal liturgies or laws, tells the parents they are a collection of the like-minded and the spiritually akin, a people, a nation. I left my office and walked down the hill and into town. There are houses in town with turrets and two-story porches where people sit in the shade of ancient maples. There are Greek Revival and Gothic churches. There is an insane asylum with an elongated portico, ornamented dormers, and a steeply pitched roof topped by a pineapple finial. Babette and I, and our children, by previous marriages, live at the end of a quiet street in what was once a wooded area with deep ravines. There is an expressway beyond the backyard now, well below us. And at night, as we settle into our brass bed, the sparse traffic washes past, a remote and steady murmur around our sleep, as of dead souls babbling at the edge of a dream. I am chairman of the Department of Hitler Studies at the College on the Hill. I invented Hitler Studies in North America in March of 1968. It was a cold, bright day with intermittent winds out of the east. When I suggested to the Chancellor that we might build a whole department around Hitler's life and work, he was quick to see the possibilities. It was an immediate and electrifying success. The Chancellor went on to serve as advisor to Nixon, Ford, and Carter before his death on a ski lift in Austria. At 4th and Elm, cars turn left for the supermarket. A policewoman crouched inside a box-like vehicle patrols the area looking for cars parked illegally, for meter violations, lapsed inspection stickers. On telephone poles all over town, there are homemade signs concerning lost dogs and cats, sometimes in the handwriting of a child. Chapter 2 Babette is tall and fairly ample. There is a girth and heft to her. Her hair is a fanatical blonde mop, a particular tawny hue that used to be called dirty blonde. If she were a petite woman, the hair would be too cute, too mischievous and contrived. Size gives her tousled aspect a certain seriousness. Ample women do not plan such things. They lack the guile for conspiracies of the body. "You should have been there," I said to her.
"Where?"
"It's the day of the station wagons."
"Did I miss it again? You're supposed to remind me."
"They stretched all the way down past the music library and onto the interstate. Blue, green, burgundy, brown. They gleamed in the sun like a desert caravan."
"You know I need reminding, Jack."
Babette, disheveled, has the careless dignity of someone too preoccupied with serious matters to know or care what she looks like.
Not that she is a gift-bearer of great things as the world generally reckons them. She gathers and tends the children, teaches a course in an adult education program, belongs to a group of volunteers who read to the blind. Once a week, she reads to an elderly man named Treadwell, who lives on the edge of town. He is known as Old Man Treadwell, as if he were a landmark, a rock formation, or brooding swamp. She reads to him from the National Enquirer, the National Examiner, the National Express, the Globe, the World, the Star. The old fellow demands his weekly dose of cult mysteries. Why deny him? The point is that Babette, whatever she is doing, makes me feel sweetly rewarded, bound up with a full-souled woman, a lover of daylight and dense life, the miscellaneous swarming air of families. I watch her all the time doing things in measured sequence, skillfully, with seeming ease, unlike my former wives, who had a tendency to feel estranged from the objective world, a self-absorbed and high-strung bunch, with ties to the intelligence community.
It's not the station wagons I wanted to see. What are the people like? Do the women wear plaid skirts, cable-knit sweaters? Are the men in hacking jackets? What's a hacking jacket?
They've grown comfortable with their money, I said. They genuinely believe they're entitled to it. This conviction gives them a kind of rude health. They glow a little.
I have trouble imagining death at that income level, she said.
Maybe there is no death as we know it, just documents changing hands.
Not that we don't have a station wagon ourselves.
It's small, it's metallic gray, it has one whole rusted door.
Where is Wilder?
She said, routinely panic-stricken, calling up to the child, one of hers, sitting motionless on his tricycle in the backyard. Babette and I do our talking in the kitchen. The kitchen and the bedroom are the major chambers around here, the power haunts, the sources. She and I are alike in this, that we regard the rest of the house as storage space for furniture, toys, all the unused objects of earlier marriages and different sets of children, the gifts of lost in-laws, the hand-me-downs and rummages. Things. Boxes. Why do these possessions carry such sorrowful weight? There is a darkness attached to them, a foreboding. They make me wary not of personal failure and defeat, but of something more general, something large in scope and content. She came in with Wilder and seated him on the kitchen counter. Denise and Steffi came downstairs, and we talked about the school supplies they would need. Soon it was time for lunch. We entered a period of chaos and noise. We milled about, bickered a little, dropped utensils. Finally, we were all satisfied with what we'd been able to snatch from the cupboards and refrigerator, or swipe from each other, and we began quietly plastering mustard or mayonnaise on our brightly colored food. The mood was one of deadly serious anticipation. A reward hard won. The table was crowded, and Babette and Denise elbowed each other twice, although neither spoke. Wilder was still seated on the counter, surrounded by open cartons, crumpled tin foil, shiny bags of potato chips, bowls of pasty substances covered with plastic wrap, flip-top rings and twist ties, individually wrapped slices of orange cheese. Heinrich came in, studied the scene carefully, my only son, then walked out the back door and disappeared.
"This isn't the lunch I'd planned for myself," Babette said. "I was seriously thinking yogurt and wheat germ."
"Where have we heard that before?" Denise said.
"Probably right here," Steffi said.
"She keeps buying that stuff." "But she never eats it," Steffi said. because she thinks if she keeps buying it, she'll have to eat it just to get rid of it. It's like she's trying to trick herself.
It takes up half the kitchen.
But she throws it away before she eats it because it goes bad, Denise said. So then she starts the whole thing all over again.
Wherever you look, Steffi said, there it is.
She feels guilty if she doesn't buy it. She feels guilty if she buys it and doesn't eat it. She feels guilty when she sees it in the fridge. She feels guilty when she throws it away.
It's like she smokes, but she doesn't, Steffi said.
Denise was 11, a hard-nosed kid. She led a more or less daily protest against those of her mother's habits that struck her as wasteful or dangerous.
I defended Babette.
I told her I was the one who needed to show discipline in matters of diet. I reminded her how much I liked the way she looked. I suggested there was an honesty inherent in bulkiness, if it is just the right amount. People trust a certain amount of bulk in others. But she was not happy with her hips and thighs, walked at a rapid clip, ran up the stadium steps at the neoclassical high school. She said I made virtues of her flaws because it was my nature to shelter loved ones from the truth. Something lurked inside the truth, she said. The smoke alarm went off in the hallway upstairs, either to let us know the battery had just died or because the house was on fire. We finished our lunch in silence.
Chapter 3 Department heads wear academic robes at the college on the hill. Not grand, sweeping, full-length affairs, but sleeveless tunics puckered at the shoulders. I like the idea. I like clearing my arm from the folds of the garment to look at my watch. The simple act of checking the time is transformed by this flourish. Decorative gestures add romance to a life. Idling students may see time itself as a complex embellishment, a romance of human consciousness, as they witness the chairman walking across campus, crooked arm emerging from his medieval robe, the digital watch blinking in late summer dusk. The robe is black, of course, and goes with almost anything. There is no Hitler building as such. We are quartered in Centenary Hall, a dark brick structure we share with the Popular Culture Department, known officially as American Environments. A curious group. The teaching staff is composed almost solely of New York emigres, smart, thuggish, movie-mad, trivia-crazed. They are here to decipher the natural language of the culture, to make a formal method of the shiny pleasures they'd known in their Europe-shadowed childhoods, an Aristotelianism of bubblegum wrappers and detergent jingles. The department head is Alphonse Fast Food Stompanato, a broad-chested, glowering man whose collection of pre-war soda pop bottles is on permanent display in an alcove. All his teachers are male, wear rumpled clothes, need haircuts, cough into their armpits. Together they look like Teamster officials assembled to identify the body of a mutilated colleague. The impression is one of pervasive bitterness, suspicion, and intrigue. An exception to some of the above is Murray J. Siskind, an ex-sports writer who asked me to have lunch with him in the dining room, where the institutional odor of vaguely defined food aroused in me an obscure and gloomy memory. Murray was new to the Hill, a stoop-shouldered man with little round glasses and an Amish beard. He was a visiting lecturer on living icons and seemed embarrassed by what he'd gleaned so far from his colleagues in popular culture.
I understand the music, I understand the movies, I even see how comic books can tell us things. But there are full professors in this place who read nothing but cereal boxes.
It's the only avant-garde we've got.
Oh, not that I'm complaining. I like it here. I'm totally enamored of this place. A small town setting. I want to be free of cities and sexual entanglements. Heat. This is what cities mean to me. You get off the train and walk out of the station and you are hit with the full blast. The heat of air, traffic, and people. The heat of food and sex. The heat of tall buildings. The heat that floats out of the subways and the tunnels. It's always 15 degrees hotter in the cities. Heat rises from the sidewalks and falls from the poisoned sky. The buses breathe heat. Heat emanates from crowds of shoppers and office workers. The entire infrastructure is based on heat, desperately uses up heat, breeds more heat. The eventual heat death of the universe that scientists love to talk about is already well underway, and you can feel it happening all around you in any large or medium-sized city. Heat and wetness.
Where are you living, Murray?
In a rooming house. I'm totally captivated and intrigued. It's a gorgeous old crumbling house near the insane asylum. 7 or 8 boarders, more or less permanent, except for me. A woman who harbors a terrible secret. A man with a haunted look. A man who never comes out of his room. A woman who stands by the letterbox for hours, waiting for something that never seems to arrive. A man with no past. A woman with a past. There is a smell about the place of unhappy lives in the movies that I really respond to.
"Which one are you?" I said.
"I'm the Jew. What else would I be?"
There was something touching about the fact that Murray was dressed almost totally in corduroy. I had the feeling that since the age of 11, in his crowded plot of concrete, he'd associated this sturdy fabric with higher learning in some impossibly distant and tree-shaded place.
"I can't help being happy in a town called Blacksmith," he said. "I'm here to avoid situations. Cities are full of situations, sexually cunning people. There are parts of my body I no longer encourage women to handle freely. I was in a situation with a woman in Detroit. She needed my semen in a divorce suit. The irony is that I love women. I fall apart at the sight of long legs striding briskly as a breeze carries up from the river on a weekday in the play of morning light. The second irony is that it's not the bodies of women that I ultimately crave, but their minds. The mind of a woman, the delicate chambering and massive unidirectional flow like a physics experiment. What fun it is to talk to an intelligent woman wearing stockings as she crosses her legs. That little staticky sound of rustling nylon can make me happy on several levels. The third and related irony is that it's the most complex and neurotic and difficult women that I am invariably drawn to. I like simple men and complicated women."
Murray's hair was tight and heavy-looking. He had dense brows, wisps of hair curling up the sides of his neck. The small stiff beard, confined to his chin and unaccompanied by a mustache, seemed an optional component, to be stuck on or removed as circumstances warranted.
"What kind of lectures do you plan giving?"
"That's exactly what I want to talk to you about," he said. "You've established a wonderful thing here with Hitler. You created it, you nurtured it, you made it your own. Nobody on the faculty of any college or university in this part of the country can so much as utter the word Hitler without a nod in your direction, literally or metaphorically. This is the center, the unquestioned source. He is now your Hitler, Gladney's Hitler. It must be deeply satisfying for you. The college is internationally known as a result of Hitler's studies. It has an identity, a sense of achievement. You've evolved an entire system around this figure, a structure with countless substructures and interrelated fields of study, a history within history. I marvel at the effort. It was masterful, shrewd, and stunningly preemptive. It's what I want to do with Elvis.
Several days later, Murray asked me about a tourist attraction known as the most photographed barn in America. We drove 22 miles into the country around Farmington. There were meadows and apple orchards. White fences trailed through the rolling fields. Soon the signs started appearing. The most photographed barn in America. We counted 5 signs before we reached the site. There were 40 cars and a tour bus in the makeshift lot. We walked along a cow path to the slightly elevated spot set aside for viewing and photographing. All the people had cameras. Some had tripods, telephoto lenses, filter kits. A man in a booth sold postcards and slides, pictures of the barn taken from the elevated spot. We stood near a grove of trees and watched the photographers. Murray maintained a prolonged silence, occasionally scrawling some notes in a little book. "No one sees the barn," he said finally. A long silence followed. "Once you've seen the signs about the barn, it becomes impossible to see the barn." He fell silent once more. People with cameras left the elevated site, replaced at once by others. "We are not here to capture an image. We are here to maintain one. Every photograph reinforces the aura. Can you feel it, Jack? An accumulation of nameless energies." There was an extended silence. The man in the booth sold postcards and slides. "Being here is a kind of spiritual surrender. We see only what the others see. The thousands who were here in the past, those who will come in the future. We've agreed to be part of a collective perception. This literally colors our vision. A religious experience in a way, like all tourism." Another silence ensued. "They are taking pictures of taking pictures," he said. He did not speak for a while. We listened to the incessant clicking of shutter release buttons, the rustling crank of levers that advanced the film. "What was the barn like before it was photographed?" he said. "What did it look like? How was it different from other barns? How was it similar to other barns?" "We can't answer these questions because we've read the signs, seen the people snapping the pictures. We can't get outside the aura. We're part of the aura. We're here. We're now." He seemed immensely pleased by this. Chapter 4. When times are bad, people feel compelled to overeat. Blacksmith is full of obese adults and children, baggy-pantsed, short-legged, waddling. They struggle to emerge from compact cars. They don sweatsuits and run in families across the landscape. They walk down the street with food in their faces. They eat in stores, cars, parking lots, on bus lines and movie lines, under the stately trees. Only the elderly seem exempt from the fever of eating. If they are sometimes absent from their own words and gestures, they are also slim and healthy-looking, the women carefully groomed, the men purposeful and well-dressed, selecting shopping carts from the line outside the supermarket. I crossed the high school lawn and walked to the rear of the building and toward the small, open stadium. Babette was running up the stadium steps. I sat across the field in the first row of stone seats. The sky was full of streaking clouds. When she reached the top of the stadium, she stopped and paused. putting her hands to the high parapet and leaning into it to rest diagonally. Then she turned and walked back down, breasts chugging. The wind rippled her oversized suit. She walked with her hands on her hips, fingers spread. Her face was tilted up, catching the cool air, and she didn't see me. When she reached the bottom step, she turned to face the seats and did some kind of neck-stretching exercise. Then she started running up the steps. 3 times she ascended the steps, walked slowly down. There was no one around. She worked hard, hair floating, legs and shoulders working. Every time she reached the top, she leaned into the wall, head down, upper body throbbing. After the last descent, I met her at the edge of the playing field and embraced her, putting my hands inside the sweatband of her gray cotton pants. A small plane appeared over the trees. Babette was moist and warm, emitting a creaturely hum. She runs, she shovels snow, she caulks the tub and sink. She plays word games with Wilder, and reads erotic classics aloud in bed at night. What do? I twirl the garbage bags and twist-tie them, swim laps in the college pool. When I go walking, joggers come up soundlessly behind me, appearing at my side, making me jump in idiotic fright. Babette talks to dogs and cats. I see colored spots out of the corner of my right eye. She plans ski trips that we never take, her face bright with excitement. I walk up the hill to school, noting the whitewashed stones that line the driveways of newer homes. Who will die first? This question comes up from time to time, like where are the car keys? It ends a sentence, prolongs a glance between us. I wonder if the thought itself is part of the nature of physical love, a reverse Darwinism that awards sadness and fear to the survivor. Or is it some inert element in the air we breathe, a rare thing like neon, with a melting point, an atomic weight? I held her in my arms on the cinder track. Kids came running our way, 30 girls in bright shorts, an improbable bobbing mass. The eager breathing, the overlapping rhythms of their footfalls. Sometimes I think our love is inexperienced. The question of dying becomes a wise reminder. It cures us of our innocence of the future. Simple things are doomed. Or is that a superstition? We watch the girls come round again. They were strung out now, with faces and particular gaits, almost weightless in their craving, able to land lightly. The Airport Marriott, the Downtown Travelodge, the Sheraton Inn, and Conference Center. On our way home, I said, "Bee wants to visit at Christmas. We can put her in with Steffi." "Do they know each other?" "They met at Disney World. It'll be all right." "When were you in Los Angeles?" "You mean Anaheim." "When were you in Anaheim?" "You mean Orlando. It's almost 3 years now." "Where was I?" she said. My daughter Bee, from my marriage to Tweedy Browner, was just starting 7th grade in a Washington suburb and was having trouble readjusting to life in the States after 2 years in South Korea. She took taxis to school, made phone calls to friends in Seoul and Tokyo. Abroad, she'd wanted to eat ketchup sandwiches with trick sticks. Now she cooked fierce, sizzling meals of scallion bushes and baby shrimp, monopolizing Tweedy's restaurant-quality range. That night, a Friday, we ordered Chinese food and watched television together, the 6 of us. Babette had made it a rule. She seemed to think that if kids watched television one night a week with parents or step-parents, The effect would be to de-glamorize the medium in their eyes, make it wholesome domestic sport. Its narcotic undertow and eerie, diseased brain-sucking power would be gradually reduced. I felt vaguely slighted by this reasoning. The evening, in fact, was a subtle form of punishment for us all. Heinrich sat silent over his egg rolls. Steffi became upset every time something shameful or humiliating seemed about to happen to someone on the screen. She had a vast capacity for being embarrassed on other people's behalf. Often she would leave the room until Denise signaled to her that the scene was over. Denise used these occasions to counsel the younger girl on toughness, the need to be mean in the world, thick-skinned. It was my own formal custom on Fridays, after an evening in front of the TV set, to read deeply in Hitler well into the night. On one such night I got into bed next to Babette and told her how the Chancellor had advised me, back in 1968, to do something about my name and appearance if I wanted to be taken seriously as a Hitler innovator. Jack Gladney would not do, he said, and asked me what other names I might have at my disposal. We finally agreed that I should invent an extra initial and call myself J.A.K. Gladney, a tag I wore like a borrowed suit. The Chancellor warned against what he called my tendency to make a feeble presentation of self. He strongly suggested I gain weight. He wanted me to grow out into Hitler. He himself was tall, paunchy, ruddy, jowly, big-footed, and dull. A formidable combination. I had the advantages of substantial height, big hands, big feet, but badly needed bulk, or so he believed, an air of unhealthy excess, of padding and exaggeration, hulking massiveness. If I could become more ugly, he seemed to be suggesting, it would help my career enormously. So Hitler gave me something to grow into and develop toward, tentative as I have sometimes been in the effort. The glasses with thick, black, heavy frames and dark lenses were my own idea, an alternative to the bushy beard that my wife of the period didn't want me to grow. Babette said she liked the series J.A.K. and didn't think it was attention-getting in a cheap sense. To her it intimated dignity, significance, and prestige. I am the false character that follows the name around. Chapter 5. Let's enjoy these aimless days while we can, I told myself, fearing some kind of deft acceleration. At breakfast, Babette read all our horoscopes aloud, using her storytelling voice. I tried not to listen when she got to mine, although I think I wanted to listen. I think I sought some clues. After dinner, on my way upstairs, I heard the TV say, "Let's sit half-lotus and think about our spines." That night, seconds after going to sleep, I seemed to fall through myself, a shallow, heart-stopping plunge. Jarred awake, I stared into the dark, realizing I'd experienced the more or less normal muscular contraction known as the myoclonic jerk. Is this what it's like? Abrupt? Peremptory? Shouldn't death, I thought, be a swan dive, graceful, white-winged, and smooth, leaving the surface undisturbed? Blue jeans tumbled in a dryer. We ran into Murray J. Siskind at the supermarket. His basket held generic food and drink, non-brand items in plain white packages with simple labeling. There was a white can labeled canned peaches. There was a white package of bacon without a plastic window for viewing a representative slice. A jar of roasted nuts had a white wrapper bearing the words, "Irregular Peanuts." Murray kept nodding to Babette as I introduced them. "This is the new austerity," he said. "Flavorless packaging. It appeals to me. I feel I'm not only saving money, but contributing to some kind of spiritual consensus. It's like World War III. Everything is white. They'll take our bright colors away and use them in the war effort." He was staring into Babette's eyes, picking up items from our cart and smelling them. "I've bought these peanuts before. They're round, cubical, pockmarked, seamed. Broken peanuts. A lot of dust at the bottom of the jar. But they taste good. Most of all, I like the packages themselves. You were right, Jack. This is the last avant-garde. Bold new forms. The power to shock." A woman fell into a rack of paperback books at the front of the store. A heavyset man emerged from the raised cubicle in the far corner and moved warily toward her, head tilted to get a clearer sightline. A checkout girl said, "Leon, Parsley," and he answered as he approached the fallen woman, 79. His breast pocket was crammed with felt-tip pens. "So then you cook at the rooming house," Babette said. "My room is zoned for a hot plate. I'm happy there. I read the TV listings. I read the ads in Ufologist Today. I want to immerse myself in American magic and dread. My seminar is going well. The students are bright and responsive. They ask questions, and I answer them. They jot down notes as I speak. It's quite a surprise in my life." He picked up our bottle of extra-strength pain reliever and sniffed along the rim of the childproof cap. He smelled our honeydew melons, our bottles of club soda and ginger ale. Babette went down the frozen food aisle, an area my doctor had advised me to stay out of. "Your wife's hair is a living wonder," Murray said, looking closely into my face as if to communicate a deepening respect for me based on this new information. "Yes, it is," I said. "She has important hair." "I think I know what you mean." "I hope you appreciate that woman." "Absolutely. Because a woman like that doesn't just happen." "I know it." "She must be good with children. More than that, I'll bet she's great to have around in a family tragedy. She'd be the type to take control, show strength and affirmation." "Actually, she falls apart. She fell apart when her mother died." "Who wouldn't?" "She fell apart when Steffi called from camp with a broken bone in her hand. We had to drive all night. I found myself on a lumber company road." Babette weeping. "Her daughter, far away, among strangers, in pain? Who wouldn't?" "Not her daughter." "My daughter." "Not even her own daughter?" "No." "Extraordinary. I have to love it." The three of us left together, trying to maneuver our shopping carts between the paperback books scattered across the entrance. Murray wheeled one of our carts into the parking lot, and then helped us heave and push all our double-bagged merchandise into the back of the station wagon. Cars entered and exited. The policewoman, in her zippered minicab, scouted the area for red flags on the parking meters. We added Murray's single lightweight bag of white items to our load and headed across Elm in the direction of his rooming house. It seemed to me that Babette and I, in the mass and variety of our purchases, in the sheer plenitude those crowded bags suggested, the weight and size and number, the familiar package designs and vivid lettering, the giant sizes, the family bargain packs with day-glow sale stickers, in the sense of replenishment we felt, the sense of well-being, the security and contentment these products brought to some snug home in our souls. It seemed we had achieved a fullness of being that is not known to people who need less, expect less, who plan their lives around lonely walks in the evening. Murray took Babette's hand on leaving.
I'd ask you to visit my room, but it's too small for two people, unless they're prepared to be intimate.
Murray is able to produce a look that is sneaky and frank at the same time. It is a look that gives equal credence to disaster and lecherous success. He says that in the old days of his urban entanglements, he believed there was only one way to seduce a woman, with clear and open desire. He took pains to avoid self-depreciation, self-mockery, ambiguity, irony, subtlety, vulnerability, a civilized world-weariness, and a tragic sense of history. The very things, he says, that are most natural to him. Of these he has allowed only one element, vulnerability, to insert itself gradually into his program of straightforward lust. He is trying to develop a vulnerability that women will find attractive. He works at it consciously, like a man in a gym with weights and a mirror. But his efforts so far have produced only this half-sneaky look, sheepish and wheedling. He thanked us for the lift. We watched him walk toward the lopsided porch, propped with cinder blocks, where a man in a rocker stared into space. Chapter 6 Heinrich's hairline is beginning to recede. I wonder about this. Did his mother consume some kind of gene-piercing substance when she was pregnant? Am I at fault somehow? Have I raised him, unwittingly, in the vicinity of a chemical dump site, in the path of air currents that carry industrial wastes capable of producing scalp degeneration, glorious sunsets? People say the sunsets around here were not nearly so stunning 30 or 40 years ago. Man's guilt in history, and in the tides of his own blood, has been complicated by technology, the daily, seeping, false-hearted death. The boy is 14, often evasive and moody, at other times disturbingly compliant. I have a sense that his ready yielding to our wishes and demands is a private weapon of reproach. Babette is afraid he will end up in a barricaded room, spraying hundreds of rounds of automatic fire across an empty mall before the SWAT teams come for him with their heavy-barreled weapons, their bullhorns and body armor.
It's going to rain tonight.
It's raining now, I said.
The radio said tonight.
I drove him to school on his first day back after a sore throat and fever. A woman in a yellow slicker held up traffic to let some children cross. I pictured her in a soup commercial, taking off her oilskin hat as she entered the cheerful kitchen where her husband stood over a pot of smoky lobster bisque, a smallish man with 6 weeks to live. "Look at the windshield," I said. "Is that rain or isn't it?"
"I'm only telling you what they said."
"Just because it's on the radio doesn't mean we have to suspend belief in the evidence of our senses."
"Our senses? Our senses are wrong a lot more often than they're right. This has been proved in the laboratory. Don't you know about all those theorems that say nothing is what it seems? There's no past, present, or future outside our own mind. The so-called laws of motion are a big hoax. Even sound can trick the mind. Just because you don't hear a sound doesn't mean it's not out there. Dogs can hear it. Other animals. And I'm sure there are sounds even dogs can't hear. But they exist in the air, in waves. Maybe they never stop. High, high, high-pitched. Coming from somewhere."
"Is it raining," I said, "or isn't it?"
"I wouldn't want to have to say."
"What if someone held a gun to your head?"
"Who? You?"
"Someone. A man in a trench coat and smoky glasses. He holds a gun to your head and says, 'Is it raining or isn't it?'
All you have to do is tell the truth, and I'll put away my gun and take the next flight out of here.
What truth does he want? Does he want the truth of someone traveling at almost the speed of light in another galaxy? Does he want the truth of someone in orbit around a neutron star? Maybe if these people could see us through a telescope, we might look like we were 2 feet 2 inches tall and it might be raining yesterday instead of today.
He's holding the gun to your head. He wants your truth.
What good is my truth? My truth means nothing. What if this guy with the gun comes from a planet in a whole different solar system? What we call rain, he calls soap. What we call apples, he calls rain. So what am I supposed to tell him?
His name is Frank J. Smalley, and he comes from St. Louis.
He wants to know if it's raining now, at this very minute.
Here and now, that's right.
Is there such a thing as now? Now comes and goes as soon as you say it. How can I say it's raining now if your so-called now becomes then as soon as I say it?
You said there was no past, present, or future.
Only in our verbs. That's the only place we find it.
Rain is a noun. Is there rain here, in this precise locality, at whatever time within the next 2 minutes that you choose to respond to the question?
If you want to talk about this precise locality while you're in a vehicle that's obviously moving, then I think that's the trouble with this discussion.
Just give me an answer, okay, Heinrich?
The best I could do is make a guess.
Either it's raining or it isn't, I said.
Exactly, that's my whole point. You'd be guessing. 6 of 1, 6 of 1 of the other.
But you see it's raining.
You see the sun moving across the sky. But is the sun moving across the sky, or is the earth turning?
I don't accept the analogy.
You're so sure that's rain. How do you know it's not sulfuric acid from factories across the river? How do you know it's not fallout from a war in China? You want an answer here and now. Can you prove here and now that this stuff is rain? How do I know that what you call rain is really rain? What is rain anyway?
It's the stuff that falls from the sky and gets you what is called wet.
I'm not wet. Are you wet?
All right, I said. Very good.
No, seriously, are you wet?
First rate, I told him. A victory for uncertainty, randomness, and chaos. Science's finest hour.
Be sarcastic.
The sophists and the hair-splitters enjoy their finest hour.
Go ahead, be sarcastic, I don't care.
Heinrich's mother lives in an ashram now. She has taken the name Mother Devi and runs the business end of things. The ashram is located on the outskirts of the former copper-smelting town of Tubb, Montana, now called Dharamsalapur. The usual rumors abound of sexual freedom, sexual slavery, drugs, nudity, mind control, poor hygiene, tax evasion, monkey worship, torture, prolonged and hideous death. I watched him walk through the downpour to the school entrance. He moved with deliberate slowness, taking off his camouflage cap 10 yards from the doorway. At such moments, I find I love him with an animal desperation, a need to take him under my coat and crush him to my chest, keep him there, protect him. He seems to bring a danger to him. It collects in the air. Follows him from room to room. Babette bakes his favorite cookies. We watch him at his desk, an unpainted table covered with books and magazines. He works well into the night, plotting chess moves in a game he plays by mail with a convicted killer in the penitentiary. It was warm and bright the next day, and students on the hill sat on lawns and in dorm windows, playing their tapes, sunbathing. The air was a reverie of wistful summer things, the last languorous day, a chance to go bare-limbed once more, smell the mown clover. I went into the Arts Duplex, our newest building. A winged affair with a facade of anodized aluminum, sea-green, cloud-catching. On the lower level was the movie theater, a sloped and dark-carpeted space with 200 plush seats. I sat in shallow light at the end of the first row and waited for my seniors to arrive. They were all Hitler majors, members of the only class I still taught, advanced Nazism, 3 hours a week, restricted to qualified seniors. A course of study designed to cultivate historical perspective, theoretical rigor, and mature insight into the continuing mass appeal of fascist tyranny, with special emphasis on parades, rallies, and uniforms, 3 credits, written reports. Every semester, I arranged for a screening of background footage. This consisted of propaganda films, scenes shot at party congresses, outtakes from mystical epics featuring parades of gymnasts and mountaineers, a collection I'd edited into an impressionistic 80-minute documentary. Crowd scenes predominated. Close-up jostled shots of thousands of people outside a stadium after a Goebbels speech, people surging, massing, bursting through the traffic. Halls hung with swastika banners, with mortuary wreaths and death's head insignia. Ranks of thousands of flag-bearers arrayed before columns of frozen light. 130 anti-aircraft searchlights aimed straight up. A scene that resembled a geometric longing, the formal notation of some powerful mass desire. There was no narrative voice, only chants, songs, arias, speeches, cries, cheers, accusations, shrieks. I got to my feet and took up a position at the front of the theater, middle aisle, facing the entranceway. They came in out of the sun in their poplin walk shirts and limited edition T-shirts, in their easy care knits, their polo styling and rugby stripes. I watched them take their seats, noting the subdued and reverent air, the uncertain anticipation. Some had notebooks and pencil lights. Some carried lecture material in bright binders. There were whispers, rustling paper, the knocking sound of seats dropping as one by one the students settled in. I leaned against the front of the apron, waiting for the last few to enter, for someone to seal the doors against our voluptuous summer day. Soon there was a hush. It was time for me to deliver the introductory remarks. I let the silence deepen for a moment, then cleared my arms from the folds of the academic robe in order to gesture freely. When the showing ended, someone asked about the plot to kill Hitler. The discussion moved to plots in general. I found myself saying to the assembled heads, "All plots tend to move deathward. This is the nature of plots. Political plots, terrorist plots, lovers' plots, narrative plots, plots that are part of children's games. We edge nearer death every time we plot. It is like a contract that all must sign, the plotters as well as those who are the targets of the plot." Is this true? Why did I say it? What does it mean? Chapter 7. 2 nights a week, Babette goes to the congregational church at the other end of town and lectures to adults in the basement on correct posture. Basically, she is teaching them how to stand, sit, and walk. Most of her students are old. It isn't clear to me why they want to improve their posture. We seem to believe it is possible to ward off death by following rules of good grooming. Sometimes I go with my wife to the church basement and watch her stand, turn, assume various heroic poses,
gesture gracefully. She makes references to yoga, kendo, trance walking. She talks of Sufi dervishes, Sherpa mountaineers. The old folks nod and listen. Nothing is foreign, nothing too remote to apply. I am always surprised at their acceptance and trust, the sweetness of their belief.